Mr. Roger Miller. King of the Road, Saturday morning. Good morning. I'm Tom Gozzi. It's hot and cold. And that goes out for our friend who we lost this week, Tony Soans from the Rock and Art Shop in Bangor, Ellsworth, and Bar Harbor. Tony passed away this past week in Arizona. And I only met him once or twice and there's certain people you meet in life who just, you see a spark, a twinkle in their eye maybe. He was an educator. If you didn't know him, he was always happy to share information about the natural world, if you want to call it that. And he'll be missed. He is missed by a lot of people. And my heart goes out to his family. That's a sad way to have to start the week, but the show, but that's his life goes on. What do we got? We got wind, man. What happened? It was nice out for a couple of days, and I said, we're going to get windy and cold on Saturday, Sunday, and then it's going to get warm again, and now the extended forecast is it's going to be cold for a whole week. I guess it is February. I guess we can deal with it. But I was looking forward to it being warm, man. We'll get through it. It's almost over. I mean, you know, end of February, you turn off the heat. So, I did actually get some work done on our building this week. A friend of mine stopped by yesterday, says, "Hey, I went over and looked at your building. Where's the overhead door?" Well, it's funny because I installed the overhead door inside the building, and I'm going to cut. I just wanted to make sure I was doing it right. I put in overhead doors before, but this framing is a little different on this building. So I set it up on the inside of the building without cutting through the siding on the outside, and it looks okay. So I picked up some stuff I needed this morning, and we'll get back at that, and then I'll poke a hole in the building. I don't make holes in buildings till I'm ready. I know what I'm doing, and even then it gets a little scary sometimes, but. But we've got the technology to make it pretty easy. Then the second thing he said was, "No overhead door, and how are you getting all this stuff in there?" Well, I'm cleaning up, and I'm organizing. So it was a busy week, so we didn't get as much done as we wanted to. You know, I keep having to run my business instead of going over and insulating a building. I don't know what that's all about. But we are making progress. I've got all the framing up that I need to have up for the insulation, so I guess I'll go over and cut insulation over the weekend, see how far I get. And then we're getting close to hooking up some heat, so that'll be good. So a couple of things I came across in the news that I thought were noteworthy. First one is of interest. In the space station, the International Space Station, they had a toilet leak. Now, a toilet leak is never a good thing anywhere. And I've been in houses where toilets have leaked and, you know, they've taken out floors, they've ruined radiant floors, they've done all kinds of horrible things. You go in the space station, it's a whole other ball game. If something leaks out of the toilet, it's floating around in the air. And that has the potential to be a problem. The good news is the toilet leak was potable water. It wasn't the other stuff that goes in there. So they were able to catch it, and, of course, it's floating around in the air, so I guess it's easier to get with a towel. But I think it was loose fitting is what it was. 2.5 gallons of water floating around. And that's not a good thing in a place like that. I mean, where it's weightless, it get into all kinds of things and cause all kinds of mischief. So that was interesting. The other interesting thing, I didn't even write it on my note thing here, that I spent a little bit of time on this week. I've been kind of mulling this over. Excuse me. We're moving in. We're setting up a new office space. I wanted to get a pellet stove for it. So I picked up one on, I think it was Facebook. I don't think it was Craigslist. It was Facebook or Craigslist. I want to say it was Facebook. That was like a year old. And it had some kind of control problem, and the owner just gave up on it. So I got it for like $300. and it's a year old. It's a Pelpro stove, and the guy had replaced the control board and it still didn't work right. So I thought, well, I could deal with that. So I grabbed the stove, and I got it back in November, I think, and it's been on a pallet in my shop so I can move it around, and I've been picking at it. It had the original control board and a new control board and a little touch screen up on the top that you push the buttons and make the thing run. And the touch screen was right behind where you would load the pellets into the stove. And I think that's relevant. And the reason it's relevant is this. Excuse me. The touch screen has a little bit of electronics, and it has a Category 5 cable, you know, like you use for networking, connected to. And it shows a code that there's no communications between the two things. So I replaced the cable. Still didn't work. I have two control boards, so I swap them back and forth. Still says there's no communications. Well, obviously, it's communicating something because it's telling me there's no communications. But so I've messed with this thing intermittently, and I started looking around. I called the company and said, well, you need the new touchpad. Now, the touchpad is probably a little bit bigger than my index finger. It's got a tiny LCD screen that tells you what's going on and four push buttons. And that little beauty is $252, which is almost what I paid for the stove. And I was almost ready to buy it a couple times. And I'm like, what if that's not the problem? Then the previous owner had spent $300 on a control board that wasn't the problem. I replaced the Category 5 cable. That's not the problem. All right, wait a minute. Stop, Tom. All right, let's go back and look at what else we can do to control a pellet stove. And I'm going to take a break here because now I've got the hook in you. And when I come back, I will explain to you, because this is a thing that goes on with every pellet stove on God's green earth, pretty much, with one or two exceptions. And I think I've worked through an interesting solution. So stay with us. We'll be right back. It's Hot and Cold Saturday morning, 8:15. Stay there. Please, don't go. Hey, we're back. Okay, turn it down, Tom. Okay, there we go. Little Paul Simon thing going on there this morning. Boy, he's done a lot of stuff, hasn't he, Mr. Simon? Let's see. So they're talking about pellet stove. So I got online, and there's people tell you how to jerry-rig your pellet stove so it works. And if you look at any heating device, there's always a number of safeties, and that has to sort of amplify, I think, with solid fuel devices, because especially a pellet stove, because you run the risk of, if you try to shut off a pellet stove in the middle of a fire, it's going to keep burning, or it's going to keep smoking or smoldering. If you shut off a gas device, you turn off the power or turn off the gas, it shuts right off. The fire goes out. Same thing with an oil burner. You stop that pump from turning, fire pretty much goes out right away. Pellet stove, You've got a little burn pot full of pellets. You have the potential for overfilling the burn pot with pellets. You have the potential, because it's usually in a living room, of filling the house with smoke, burning the house down, all these wonderful things that are associated with solid fuel. So there's a lot of dangers, possibilities here, but pellet stove manufacturers have made it work, and unfortunately a lot of this is blended into electronics, slightly sophisticated electronics, not crazy sophisticated. But so let me go back to the stove that I'm talking about that I got. There's integrated circuits, and it's a little mini computer. It doesn't do a lot of stuff, but it's a computer basically. So it's got integrated circuits. Integrated circuits and electronics like that in general tend to be sensitive to static electricity. So I don't know if you know this or not, but pellets are really oven dry, and they tend to be staticky. So here I am now. I got this stove. Got this little touch screen on the back of the stove on the top. Right in front of that touch screen is the hopper for the pellets. You open up the cover, you pour the pellets in. So what's the potential there of a static discharge at some point? I think it's more significant than not. Did that cause the problem? I don't know. Am I going to spend $252 on a little thingamabob? No. So what's my option? Get a controller from another stove. They're all sell for a couple hundred, $200-$300. Do I want to rejigger the whole thing with the wrong control, finding it doesn't work? Well, no. So I sat down and looked at the operation of the pellet stove. And there's several things a pellet stove does. And I'm going in some semblance of reality chronologically. When you hit the button to turn the stove on, it starts to feed pellets to fill the hopper. If it has an igniter, the igniter, which is they call them cal rods or electric sticks or whatever. It's about the diameter of a pencil, maybe 3-4 inches long. It's an electric heater. Gets really hot. That is underneath or in. It's adjacent to the burn pot, and usually they blow air over it, and it gets hot enough to ignite the pellets. That usually runs for maybe 10 minutes to ignite the fire. There are two blowers normally. One is a blower that is usually either blowing air into the combustion chamber or exhausting it out of the combustion chamber, one or the other. Blowing in is called a forced draft. Excuse me, drawing out is called an induced draft. You're inducing a draft. You're moving air across the thing. And the fourth function is a blower for the room. They have blowers to distribute the heat, get the heat out of the unit more efficiently. And these all have to work together with basically just timers. But you also have to have safeties. So you have to, if the pellets don't ignite, the thing has to time itself out and shut off. Thing should not come on if it doesn't have a draft. So there's a function, there's a control that senses air movement out of the exhaust. So there's people out there in computer land and internet land who have put together different schemes for doing this with and without all the safeties. So the safeties are usually blended in, not in the electronics part of the system as such, but in are hardwired into the different controls to keep things relatively safe. So what I've done is looked at what everybody's done. I've chewed on this for, what is it, February, 3 months, 4 months? And I finally came up with some controls that will do the same thing for me for about $30. So here's the thing. I'm not going to leave the stove alone. It's going to be in our office run when we're there. But everything is adjustable, the same as the pellet stove controls would be, and we'll see if it works or not. But I will not leave it. You know, the one thing I do appreciate is that I'm burning wood here, basically, and I will not leave the stove alone, and we never do. There's always somebody, even the stove I have in my shop now, the pellet stove that's there, I do not leave it alone, even though it's all original equipment. For me, that's just, you know, it's common sense. So I will report back to you maybe next week. I've got the controls look good. Some of them came on Thursday, and what is today, Saturday? Thursday and Friday just didn't happen. There was a bunch of stuff going on. So I might get to it over the weekend and start to play with it a little bit and just see how much of a mess I can make. Basically, I'm just going to keep the stove on a pallet, move it outside when we try it. That was a great weekend for that. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. Our text line is 601-207-4478. By the way, going back to the pellet stove thing for a minute, there's a guy on YouTube who has done this, who shows you a way to jerry-rig your pellet stove. I would strongly advise you do not do what he does because he eliminates all the safeties. And it's crude. It works to the degree that it makes fire. But I would be if you want an educational process of getting an idea of what's going on, it's worth looking at. But I wouldn't stake my family's life on the fact that I went to Home Depot and picked up a couple of light dimmer switches and put this thing together. That it's just not worth it. The safeties are all there for a reason, and the reason is that you don't want to die in a fire. It's not a don't want to die anyway, but we certainly don't want to burn the house down because of something stupid we did. So, what else we got? I part of the reason I didn't get to it this week to hook it up was I got some cars in, and I picked up a car, and I'm not trying to sell it, okay? I'm just telling you the story because it was fascinating to me. 2005 Prius. Go figure, I bought a Prius. 147,000 miles on it. And I've said this before, this is the cleanest car I've ever been in. Well, I think this one gets the new award. And the reason it gets the award is, A, it's super clean, but B, nothing was worn on the car. Now, this is a 2005 car. 147,000 miles is not a lot in the overall realm of used cars, in my world at least, when it comes to a Prius. They just don't age the same. But you still, you're opening the doors, you're turning the knobs, you're flipping the windshield wipers on. There's a little rubbing here. The gild is off the lily a little bit. I'm driving this thing up. I've been flopping around in the garage all day, and I went to pick up the car Thursday afternoon. And I get in the car, and I'm like, I'm going to make this car dirty. It's too nice. And it took a sticker. I knew it would. It just was, you just, the condition of it was just kind of like, wow. So that was a pleasant surprise. And I have a feeling it was one of those, it was a grampy car. I'm old enough to be a grampy, but I'm not. So I could say that, can I? I think I get away with that. Anyway, we're going to take another break. It's already 8:30. The stories just eat up all the time. Phone number is 1-800-966-1039. A text 601-207-4478. I will answer the phone when you call. That's what I'm going to do. That's what we do here. Let's see. What do we got that's good? We got this right here. We'll be back, though. It's hot and cold. Stay with us. It's hot. It was 8:30. I said that. Yeah. Hey, we're back. It's 8:35. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. Good morning again. I'm Tom. Phone number is 1-800-966-1039. Text line 601-207-4478. Let's do this. Let's go right back over right to the phones. First call of the day. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Hey.
Hey, I asked my question last week right at the end of the show. It was regarding the tucking the wood stove into the corner and seeing how close I could get the smokestack hole going out the top.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to come out from the corners, a minimum of like 4, maybe 5 feet out from the corner and have like a, not a structural, but it's just for looks, a wall, rock and mortar, old timey looking.
Mm-hmm.
That's roughly 4 to 6 inches thick. Can I just, like, put up some galvanized sheets and then just do the plaster and rock wall over that? And that would be a thick enough non-combustible barrier between, the heat and the wall?
Well, how far, I guess the question is going to be how far away the stove spec is in terms of how, it's not a combustible wall as such. If it was studded with, if it was built not out of wood, the wall structure itself, but steel studs, and you had stone over it, yeah, you can be fairly close. Again, as I think I said last week, the stove should have a spec on it. If it doesn't, they want you to assume the clearance to combustibles has to be 3 feet. But you don't have combustibles if you're steel studding it and putting stone over. So that becomes a safety, if you will.
Right. Wow, because, it just seems like I've read about it, and they're like, leave an airspace behind for it to...
Is this a new stove or an old stove?
No, it's a future stove. A rectangle stove, feed it from the front.
But
so it.
I'm not familiar with the brand. Is it new, relatively new stove? Because there should be some spec on it.
A future stove that I plan to get.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes,
I thought future stove. I'm not familiar with that brand.
Yes, specifically for the corner, rectangle to where it looks good in there. It's not a square.
Sure,
you know.
I understand. So it's simple enough if you're buying a used stove to look on it. Usually, if it's a fairly current one, there will be a label on the back, a UL
right.
label or an Omni Labs label that tells you what the clearances are, which would give you some guidance and make give you a level of comfort. If it's an old stove that doesn't have any information, you're supposed to assume 3 feet. It behooves you anyway to get something that's a little bit newer because it's going to be more efficient. It's going to burn cleaner. It's going to save you, you know, a lot of aggravation. And a lot of those stoves have pretty good clearance or don't require major clearance. But again, if you're doing a massive wall, if the wall behind the rock is masonry is wooden framed, that becomes a little bit of an issue. And the way around this would be to have a ventilation space behind it. And I'm hedging here a little bit because I've seen places where everything looks great and then somebody takes it apart and all the wood is charred because of the exposure to heat for such a long term. And wood has this weird thing of if it's exposed to drying and heat over a prolonged period of time, maybe years, its combustion point keeps dropping. So that's the reason that we tend to be a little bit conservative about this because you can't, as I said earlier, you can't just turn the fire off in the stove. Not easily anyway. Again, with a new stove or a fairly recently made stove, it's going to have that information on it, and you may be in good shape in terms of just having the right stove for your situation.
Yeah, hopefully I can figure something, you know, like 3 feet from the back corner of the stove would be like way more than...
That's a big clearance, and it's a belt and suspenders approach just to be safe. But most stoves, when I say new, I mean probably within the past 15 years, most of those stoves have got labels on them. All the ones you look at a hardware store or Home Depot that are not the really funky stoves that somehow they sell that shouldn't be sold, we'll have a label on it that tells you exactly what you can do, or it's in the manual.
Right. And if it's a stove that might have a built-in kind of reflector shield
that helps.
On the back,
that helps
that
a lot.
Help me.
Yeah, that's going to buy you a lot.
Yeah, cool.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Okay, welcome. Bye-bye. Bye. Yeah, we don't want to play too much with it just because of the potential. So the clearance to combustibles it's kind of like, I'm going to put the gasoline in this bucket. I'm going to have a cigarette. No, you shouldn't have a cigarette. let's not play with fire too much. Oh, you can play with fire, but let's do it. Let's be careful about it. Understand the risk. There we go. Risk assessment on Saturday mornings. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Good morning, Tom. Just have a quick automotive question, so to speak for you.
Sure.
I remember growing up as a kid, every one time, my dad always had the dry gas in the car, and he always instilled that in us to have that when we were driving.
Mm-hmm.
Done the same thing to my kids. But with all the ethanol in the gas now, is there any need for it to carry the dry gas around anymore?
No. The ethanol is basically dry gas, so it's less of an issue. And as long as you're using gas that's got ethanol, it's not necessary.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, sir,
okay.
I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, maybe somebody had a different thought, but generally speaking, I remember years ago I bought a Saab 96, and it had sat for a while and had water in the gas tank, and I never realized. I went through all kinds of things trying to figure out what was going on. It's always good to start with the obvious and work your way forward from there, and I didn't know anything about cars at the time, or thought I did, but I didn't. And I knew enough to be really dangerous and spent a lot of money figuring out that ultimately there was just water in the gas. I did figure it out eventually, but winter was over at that point. That's a lot less. And real water in a gas tank this, I mean, this had apparently had a significant amount. And every time it got cold, it froze, and it was just like, what's going on here? Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. We got a text line, 601-207-4478, if you'd like to call in. Well, we got a break here. Pause. I'll tell you about my friend Alan at General Appliance and Brewer. He's on Center Street, open 9 to 4 Monday through Friday for appliance parts and service. Excuse me, for used appliances, gas appliances, anything you could think you need to fix on an appliance, you need to call Alan at 989-4341. He will guide you through the pitfalls of having a major home appliance that just ain't working right. And we'll tell you what you can fix, what you can't fix, what he could fix, what he can't fix, and when the time comes to buy a new appliance. 989-4341, your friend in the appliance repair service industry. That's Alan at General Appliance. So that's a good person to know. And let's I came across this thing. A Swiss company is doing prefab buildings out of wood. Go figure. But a little different. No nails. No glue. The wood is what they're making the building out of. And what they're and it's solid and no insulation. Solid wood. So they make up a 8-inch wood wall, which is about R12. And then they double it. This is solid wood now. The wood is about an inch thick. Each is planks, basically, and they're laminated together with wooden, get this, wooden nails. Not now, they have the pegs like the old timber framers used, but they also have beech nails that get shot into the wood with the pneumatic nailer. Okay? And it looks pretty impressive. And if you ask me the name of the company, I'm going to lie because I can't remember. I can't imagine it's cost effective. It's an expensive building from what I understand, but it's kind of an interesting one and has some interesting potential. I've always maintained, you know, as we live here in the state of Maine, which is a forested state, which is one of the reasons I live here, we lament the collapse of the paper industry, as before that we lamented the collapse of the lumber industry. The trees are still growing. You know, we're burning some for pellets, we're burning some for firewood, but lion's share of it is being exported, perhaps, not necessarily being used to add value. We have this tremendous potential. I'm not espousing an all wood building that's just solid wood. It doesn't quite make sense, but there's a lot of variations on that basic theme that would make sense. But these guys, being Swiss, have engineered to the nth degree a pretty impressive structure. Basically, they're making plywood that's 8 inches thick using 1-inch boards, and they're nailing the suckers together with beech nails, which to me is the most innovative part of the whole deal. How do you get a beech nail to go into this? I think the structure is all softwood. I'm not positive about that. There's some YouTube videos up, and I'll see if I can find it during the next break. They also are making they make trusses, of course, which are all wooden. You know, a regular truss, if you're looking at it, a truss you buy in the U.S. or Canada for that matter, this is going to be a wooden truss, but it's got metal plates joining the truss members together. These guys don't do that. It's all wood with wood pegs. They might peg the trusses. I'm not sure they use the beech nails. But they look gorgeous right out of the box. I mean, to me, trusses look great anyway, even with the metal plates. I wouldn't mind just looking at those. I think they're attractive. But being an all wooden truss without the metal plates, they go up a notch in terms of attractiveness, and so that's kind of cool. They also make a floor, and they're doing this company was building an office building for themselves that was probably 6 or 7 stories high, and the floor was a truss that was a little bit different, and what they were doing to deaden the this primarily wood structure had a central core that was concrete. I suspect it was fire rated, you know, stairwell, because it was a taller than a couple stories. But the floors and the ceilings and the walls were all wood. In the case of the floors, it's a sort of a wood lattice, with space in that's open, and you can look down in. You're looking at the ceiling, which is solid, of course, on the floor below it, and they're filling this floor up with sand. And the idea behind the sand was twofold. One was to deaden sound from floor to floor, which, of course, it would do. In maybe a more conventional building, that would have been a reinforced concrete floor. But the sand is easy to apply. The wood floor goes in pretty quick, and you put the sand in after the fact, I guess. They also had a lightweight aggregate that they could use in lieu of sand to keep it lighter if they needed to. But then, being a lattice, they've got a space for radiant floor tubing, which opens the door from interesting possibilities. Now, this whole concept, and we've talked about this, I think, a week or so ago, even though it's wood, which is relatively insulative, wood still has an 8-inch or a 16-inch wood structure has a tremendous amount of thermal mass. So as the wall gets thicker, the R-value, of course, increases. The big focus of this company was a very tight building. It seems to be a trademark of a lot of European buildings is to make them very airtight. So if you've got an airtight building that is nominally insulated, it's maybe not as much as it should be, but in the case of coming into the U.S. market, it would be that double wall of 16 inches to get up to R20 plus. You've got a tremendous amount of mass there that lends itself to any kind of heating scheme. And if the building is tight, I know this morning it was really windy down at my house, and I've got a leaky door, and I could tell you that the wind is affected by that, or the door, excuse me, is affected by that wind. They're not suffering that consequence. So the infiltration rate is very, very low in the structure. They also do a variation on the theme where the basic eight inch wall is pretty much their standard, and then they'll add another 8-inch wall on the outside that they will use insulation in. They'll use a rock wall insulation, which if you've already got an airtight structure inside of that insulation package, that's great. The insulation, in this case, rock wall, which is a great insulation anyway, is going to perform as spec'd. There's no air moving through it that is compromising its R value. Having said all that, it is European and it is crazy expensive. But there's something to be learned from this particular concept that I should not fall on deaf ears in a state like Maine. You know, we're always concerned about the forest industry, and as one who was at one time in his life a licensed forester, believe it or not, as part of my checkered past, we've got the forest. The other thing we have that blends into this is the cement industry. And there are a number of different technologies. You know, we have a composite slab up in Orono, and they're compositing wood with all kinds of stuff and compositing other things together. But the one thing that I've always found fascinating is compositing wood with cement. And a couple of interesting things happen. Cement is cement. It sticks things together. Maybe it's not like adhesive cement, like isocyanates or urethanes or epoxies or even wood type glues, but cement still can be somewhat structural when blended with wood. And an interesting couple of interesting things happen when you do that. One is you can make a potentially make a lighter composite. Instead of being solid wood, it's a composite maybe of wood fiber, sawdust, wood chips with cement, and it basically will stick together with the cement and can be structural. But also it becomes fire retardant because the cement is naturally fire retardant material. But also another big one is the fact that cement blended with wood is rot resistant and insect resistant. Insects don't seem to like to chew through cement, even if it's just a sort of a surface coating around some particles of wood. It just doesn't happen. So anyway, I put that out there. I'll see if I can pull up the video during the break here of what the company was, because it was an interesting video to watch. It's American YouTube video. Some guys do things on buildings, and they went to Switzerland and did some really nice videos on the structures. They have two actual videos. One is of the plant showing all the nuts and bolts, and then the other one was in the actual office building, as I say, which was it wasn't a skyscraper, but it was sizable enough that it was significant. And of course, the other big thing for these guys is they're sequestering carbon. When you're using wood, you're taking carbon out of the atmosphere, which is a good thing. So let's see, we got the tunes. We're gonna go right there. There we go. It doesn't take long to program the radio show on Saturday morning. So when we come back, we'll take calls at 1-800-966-1039. We got the text line, and there were no texts as of this moment in time. Whole first hour's gone with no texts. I'm feeling neglected. At text line is 601-207-4478. If I give the right number, maybe we get texts. Anyway, stay with us. We'll be back in just a little bit. Hot and cold, Saturday morning. Okay, we're back. It's 906 here on the Voice of Maine. It's the Saturday morning Twist Party. I'm Tom, your DJ, official Twister. When I was a kid growing up, they used to have, I don't know if you ever saw this, they had like a five-minute film, it wasn't video back then, of Chubby Checker teaching you how to do the twist, in case you couldn't figure that out for yourself. That was choice stuff. I tell you, I learned the twist from Chubby Checker himself. Not from no book. There wasn't no book learning involved. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. We got text line 601-207-4478. Let's see. Here we go. I got a question. I got polarity wrong on a 6-volt golf cart battery in a bank of four, and it boiled for a few seconds before I pulled the cable. Any damage? Probably not. I would put it on the charger and make sure it's back up to. I would recharge all your batteries, because obviously you're inducing very rapid energy flow, and it doesn't hurt just to balance the pack again. You only got four of them, so I would just put them on the charger, make sure they're all back up to snuff where you want them to be. So that's that. And let's go over to the phone. We got some phone calls coming in. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine. Hello. Hello? Okay, here's the deal. When you call, you have to listen to the phone, because that phone thing is what I communicate with you on. If you're listening to the radio, there's a delay, and you're not going to we got 8 seconds of me going, hello, so listen to the phone, and we'll talk. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hey. Hey.
So I had talked to you a little bit when I went and bought that car from you about the problem I have with my house, and I'll explain it and tell you what I think might be a solution and then get your comments.
Okay.
So my ceilings are hung ceilings, kind of like what you see in commercial buildings. There's a steel framing that's suspended from the ceiling, and then you have these 2-foot by 4-foot tiles that are made of kind of like a fiberglass insulation type thing.
Yep.
And the problem with those is that not being a sheetrock ceiling, the moisture easily gets up through them into the attic. And that causes frost to form on the bottom of the roof sheathing. And that can build up. And then in the spring, when it defrosts, you get water coming down and messing things up.
Sure.
In the ceiling, there's about, I think, 6-inch insulation, fiberglass insulation is all that's up there right now. What I was thinking of doing was taking plastic and going up into the attic and covering the current 6-inch insulation with plastic for a vapor barrier, which if I just left it like that, I would think that the frost would form on the bottom of that. And so I was thinking of covering that plastic with another 6, 8, or 12 inches of fiberglass insulation. So what do you think of that? Do you think that would solve the problem?
Probably not. There's a possibility that if you cover it with more insulation, you'll get it above the dew point, but my concern is if you use fiberglass again, it might not go above the dew point where the plastic interface is. And God forbid there's any leaks in that plastic, you're still going to be dealing with a similar issue. Basically we're looking at ceiling joists with fiberglass in between them, nothing holding the fiberglass up other than it's stapled in place, or it's got little metal things to hold it up?
Okay, so I'm not sure what the material is. It's kind of like a cardboard, and I should have mentioned this. Tacked to the joists is some kind of like a cardboard, half-inch thick or so cardboard material,
mm-hmm.
So that the fiberglass insulation is sitting on top of that.
Okay. I'm just going to throw out some idle thoughts here, random thoughts. one solution would be where you have something at least semi-rigid, would be to have somebody spray the room side above the ceiling with a layer of foam, maybe an inch thick, even a half inch, enough that they could seal everything. That would get you away, give you a very high integrity moisture barrier. It's not necessarily the cheapest way to go, but that would work. And they don't necessarily have to take the whole ceiling down because they can, you know, take out access points and spray around. I think that would solve the issue. The other one where you do have something holding up what's there now, if you put a layer of plastic on the top side, you'd have to be kind of meticulous, I think, in sealing it properly. And then I would consider using 12 inches of cellulose on top of that, instead of just fiberglass. If I was using fiberglass, I would have blown-in fiberglass at the very least, just something that can pack better than bats, because bats just don't, you've got all these gaps, and it just doesn't seal very well, whereas blown-in would be a lot better.
I see.
And it,
right. Now, if I put the plastic up there, I would be sealing around every support or whatever that,
yep.
I had to go around when I put the plastic up there. I would seal that probably with spray foam insulation just to make sure that it's all sealed thoroughly before I put.
I think
on
you
top
would.
Of it.
I think spray foam isn't necessarily going to seal polyethylene to anything, but builder's tape would, and I would also be using something like a butyl caulk, which would is very sticky and stays sticky for its entire life, and you'll hate me for having suggested it, but it really is tenacious and, you know, and acting as a good sealant if you're sealing to the edge where there's wood or something. But that will and then, you know, if you're access, because it is certainly, as a do-it-yourself project, easier to access from the roof side, I think. And then, if you blow in something on top of that, whatever it is that's fluffy, again, cellulose being preferable because it's a smaller fiber, it's going to pack better. And you could do yourself. Fiberglass, you're going to have somebody do it for you.
Sure.
My first choice, though, suggestion would be to use cellulose.
Sure. Very good.
I think that'll get you there.
Have a good day, and I'm loving the car.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it. Thanks, Ted.
All right, Tom. All right.
Okay, yeah. Bye-bye. Yeah. And having met Ted, I know he's meticulous enough that he could do it right. So it's 9:14 here at the voicemail. We got a couple of text messages. Let's see. How does a non-electric EcoFan work on a wood stove? Good question. EcoFan has what's called a thermocouple device inside of it. It's basically two wires that are connected together at a point. And being dissimilar materials, if one side of there actually is a device that has a lot of these points inside of it called a Peltier device. And if one side is heated and the other side is relatively cool, it'll generate an electric current, which is enough to drive that little eco fan that sits on top of the stove by temperature differential. And you'll notice on the top side of the fan, you've got these big fins. That's the cool side. The hot side, of course, is sitting right on the stove. And even though sitting right on top of a stove in the air, above the stove, maybe it's 200 degrees. The surface of the stove may be 600 degrees. That's a big temperature differential. It's enough to generate the current to drive what is a fairly small fan. It's not a very efficient device, but it does do the job. And you can, if you are so inclined, you can buy Peltier devices and have all kinds of great fun with them. They use them a lot for they work in both directions. If you put a temperature differential across them, they will generate power. Very small amounts, but they will generate power, and you could hook them up in series and parallel to get more juice out of them. But the efficiency's not, if it's a percent, probably that's a lot. But if you put a current to the device, one side gets hot, one side gets cold. And you'll see these coolers that you can put in your car that you plug into a cigarette lighter to keep your can of beer cold so you have cold beer while you're driving. That's a Peltier device. And the tabletop refrigerators for wine, a lot of those are run by Peltier devices. Peltier device does not give you the thermal advantage the refrigeration cycle gives you with refrigerant and a compressor and stuff, but they're somewhat inexpensive. They're not as efficient to run, but they do the trick. I got to take a break here. We're going to go right there, hit the tune machine, and when we come back, we'll take some more calls. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. Stay with us. Oh, but I have to. Ringo, I got to talk. It's the radio show. I'm sorry. Hey, I apparently had hit that and was playing while I was during the break, and I got very confused. It's very easy, but that's okay. It's hot and cold Saturday morning, so we can be confused. We're here to solve confusion, mitigate obtuseness, and otherwise spend 2 hours together. Got some text messages here. Do those magic heaters that go in stovepipes plug up easily? Possibly. Depends on the stove. Depends on the type of stove. I had one on a 18-something, probably 1870, cast iron stove that my friend Kurt gave me. He had it in pieces on his front lawn. I said, Kurt, I could use that. And all the parts were there. I put it all back together, glued it together, and obviously the stack temperature was high. And I always ran it out straight. I never played with the damper. It was just wide open. And I put a magic heat on because the stack temperature was so high. And we never really got into mischief with it. The mischief and the hilarity comes in when you adjust the damper to make it burn longer. At that point, you're putting more crud into the chimney. Most of these devices have a little dew flicker that scrapes stuff off the tubes. You do have to be meticulous about keeping an eye on that because where they're cooling the flue pipe down, there's a potential there to create creosote buildup. That's never a good thing, especially in a device like that, because they're not very heavy metal. So if they did catch on fire, it ain't going to be pretty. Let's see. Tom, I have a camp stove from a company called BioLite. It has a cord. You can charge your phone while making coffee at camp. Pretty cool. Yes, that's a Peltier device. I watched the guys who made that. They had it on, I think, Shark Tank. And, it's a simple thing. As most things are, a lot of the stuff is on Shark Tank. Obviously, they're making income out of it, and it's all good. And then Tom up Sangerville wants to know, is there any way to bring EcoFans back to life? I suspect not. If it's died, it might have died because the device broke down. And I've never tried to take one. I don't know if you can take them apart. If you can, you may be able to put a new Peltier device in. The Peltier devices, by the way, are only a couple of bucks each, so you can have great fun with them. You can, as a matter of fact, you could stack them up, hot to cold to hot to cold, and excuse me, and do all kinds of fun stuff with them. There's a lot of interesting possibilities with those. So there. Let's go back to the phones at 1-800-966-1039. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I got a question on my cellar cement walls. There's like a white, flaky, powdery stuff
yep.
on the walls. And I wondered, first of all, what causes that? And also, can I just, with a stiff brush, brush it down and then coat the walls with something?
Yeah.
Or what's your feeling on that?
It's called efflorescence. It's basically like some sodium or calcium salts coming out of the wall with as moisture evaporates. You can paint it, that will probably help to mitigate it. I would use some kind of at least mildly waterproof paint to and I don't think it'd ever be a problem. And you can just brush it off, yeah.
Okay. All right, great. Thank
okay.
you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We got another one here, another text message. Is Peltier the same as Sterling? No. Sterling engine is running off temperature differential, but it's a physically a mechanical device. Excuse me, a Peltier device is pure electronics or pure electric. Similar concept though; they're working off temperature differential. Neither is very efficient. A Sterling device is more efficient than a Peltier device, but you could put together a lot of the Peltier devices to. I guess to maybe make them slightly more efficient. I picked up a bunch of them, and in the process of getting my office stuff packed up, found them. I have to remember where those are, and I've completely forgot where they are. They're in a box somewhere, so probably around June or July I'll find them again and do something with them. But it's kind of interesting to hook it up to a battery. And feel one side get hot, one side get cold, and they get quite cold. And if you can buy them, they use them a lot of times to cool integrated circuits like a computer chip. And the one side to draw heat off the chip is the device right against the chip. The opposite side, there'll be a big heat sink, a big thin piece of aluminum to allow that heat to dissipate, to make that create that temperature differential. And if it's a really significant thing, it may have a fan on it to enhance the cooling effect on the cold side, they're fun devices and they're literally a couple of buck or two each. So think of the fun. I mean, if you want to have some fun with your kids, you want to teach them something about science. It's certainly a fun project that isn't going to break the bank and is fascinating to deal with. Let's go over to line two. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Good morning, Tom.
Hi.
I've got I'm planning on insulating my basement. I've got a daylight basement with a lot of exposed concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if I'd run into any problems, you know, like how they usually insulate from the rim joist, you know, down usually 4 feet or a couple feet below grade.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if I'd be insulating down to the floor since I've got so much exposed concrete, if I'd run into any trouble with any cracking because of frost.
I would insulate to the floor, and I would just keep an eye on the outside if anything is cracking. Usually a good reinforced concrete wall should be fine. If there's any sign of cracking, you need to seal the cracking, that is. So water okay. doesn't get in and work, but I suspect there'll still be enough heat flow out to keep it from having an issue.
And going with 2 inch from the floor, I mean from the rim joist all the way down to the floor.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to be.
Now, I'm going to be framing up basically finishing part of the basement off.
Mm-hmm.
Am I better off staying off the insulation and just having them spray the insulation and then framing away from that? I've got spots where I'm limited on room, so if I could, you know, I was thinking maybe about sandwiching maybe like some half-inch rigid foam between the two buys and then having them spray in between that.
If you're going to have somebody spray it, I would just hold the wall off a half inch or so, let the foam will go in behind your stud.
Okay.
And it's a little more expensive to do it that way. Sheet foam is cheaper, but it becomes an adhesive thing as well, where the foam is now bonding the wood structure to the masonry wall, and I think I would take that approach. If you put the sheet foam in between, it kind of is a structural break. It just, to me, kind of makes a little more sense to, yeah. And the gap is fine. I mean, I think a half inch gap is adequate where you're going to go in between studs and have maybe 2 inches overall. I think that's okay. A good approach.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Right.
Bye-bye.
Let's see. We got to take a break here. I got a text message just came in. I'll read it. I'll read it during the break. That's what I'll do. I could do that. I have. And I found the Swiss company that does the wooden thing too. We'll share that with you when we come back. It's hot and cold. It's Saturday morning, 9:31. Don't go. Don't, please. I got 24 minutes. I got to fill. And if you're not there to listen, nobody makes. It just won't be right. Stay there, please. Yeah, Mr. Arlo Guthrie, Saturday morning, 9:36 on Hot and Cold. Hey, I almost I am embarrassed, and I don't embarrass easily because I do a radio show. If you listen to the show with any regularity, you know that I endlessly embarrass myself, and I the good news is I don't remember when I leave, unless you remind me, so don't remind me. But I almost embarrassed myself. I did not do it, but guess whose birthday it is today? You ready? Joe Pesci's birthday. So there. You know what? And wait a minute. Whoa, we got to. Just hang on here. Don't. If I had known this earlier, I would have done this. And here we go. Right there. Here we go. You ready? The drummer with these guys, Joe Pesci. We're talking to Twist still. I was picking up those vibrations last hour. That Chubby Checker and Joey D and the Starlighters. Joe Pesci played drums for them. Anyway, and in Newark, New Jersey, Joe Pesci, he played the drums. Can you go figure, huh? Also is a whole bunch of birthdays. Let's see. I don't usually do birthdays, but tomorrow's Roberta Flack's birthday. And who else we got for the rest of the week here? Sergio Mendez. Joe Pesci, by the way, is 76. And he's a good 76. You know what I'm saying? And I was going to, during the break, I was going to pull up some Joe Pesci quotes, you know, like Joe Pesci's angriest moments. Somebody has that on YouTube. I can't play it on the radio. There's just too many surprises. we will save that for you to do on your own at home, because it ain't happening on this radio program. Not without the FCC coming to shut me down on Saturday morning. Let's see. We've got some text messages here. This text, you don't want me to read this on the air, but I'm gonna, there's only one, sometimes stereo stuff doesn't come across this station properly. So, I notice it when I play it. If I'm playing it in the studio, I can't always pick it up, but I know out there in Radio Land you can. So I apologize. If you have a channel missing, okay, I usually play tunes that you any tune that would be stereo that you might have a missing channel on, you're going to know the part that's missing, and I want you to sing along with it or make the appropriate instrumentation so we can, you know, have some continuity here, some flow, if you will. Back to the phones. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Hello.
Hi.
I've got a room, north-facing room, 20 feet long, 9-foot ceiling, 10 feet by 4 feet of glass.
Mm.
If I got some honeycomb shades for that I pull down at night,
yeah,
how much money would I save on heat?
Oh, that's a good question. At a bare minimum, a regular shade, just pulling the shade down and having it so it sits right on the windowsill. There's no air gap for air to sneak by, but it's sitting on the sill. You'll save at least 10% just with a regular shade. So a honeycomb shade is going to be a little bit more because, you know, it depends who you believe in terms of R value. But I'll say 20% just of the window heat loss, which would be significant.
Does it make a difference if you get the 2 or the 3 honeycombs?
I think more is better. I would be then making the judgment call in terms of price, but having that extra barrier in the center adds at least an R1 to the equation and probably a little bit more.
Because the websites say that their R value goes up like 4.5 or something.
That sounds about right, yeah.
And the double pane glass is what, R2, R1?
Yeah, R2.
R2.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Are they real expensive, the double honeycombs?
It's from one of the major brands. No, it's a couple $100, I think, to do the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, if it's a room that comfort is an issue in, it certainly will enhance it significantly.
F8, if I were diligent, I'd pull them down every single night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
again, the shade, whatever it is, should sit on the sill so there's no place, because what happens is cold air is spilling down the surface, it's coming in over the top, so if it's sealed at the top and sealed at the bottom, we create a dead air space behind there, and we don't have convection taking place, and it just works better.
If you spend more money, you can get them so that the rail, or whatever you want to call it, goes all the way down the sides. So they say they're sealed up much tighter.
Yeah, it does make a difference. The trade-off there, I think, in having the side rails is that you're going to have less frost on the window when you pull it up because you've got less room air that was sneaking back out. Where room air, the heated air, is going to have a little bit more moisture in it. So I'm not going to tell you which one to get. You can. It becomes a question of economics at that point.
But it might be a 20% improvement.
I think so, yeah. On the window heat loss, which is a significant probably part of the whole room. That's
it's
a big window.
It's a big, three big windows.
Okay, yeah.
So they're 10 feet across and about 4.5 feet tall.
Yeah.
And the whole room's only 20 feet long.
Yeah. It must be lovely sitting on a day like today out there on the north side.
Yeah. I mean, the sun is going to be a wash. I'll leave them up also.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Tim.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay. Yeah, the good news is if you were a painter, that's the room to paint in the summertime, not necessarily this time of year. What else we got? There was some. Oh, the Swiss guys. Oh, did I delete it? Let me see here. I was going with the Joe Pesci thing that I. Jeez. Well, let's do it again. If you go into YouTube and you put, if you could spell Swiss like I can't, Swiss wooden house, it's the first hit. So just go into YouTube and do Swiss woodhouse or Swiss wooden house. And it says this Swiss builder uses no insulation. And the company is Kuhnholz. K-U-E-N-G, Kuhnholz Bau. And I think Siga is another name that's associated with this. And it's worth a look-see if you're interested in this kind of stuff. It's fun to look at just from its beautiful work. You know, it's made in Switzerland. It's going to be gorgeous. So there. Our phone number, 1-800-966-1039, Texas 601-207-4478. I have a guy I deal with who is an engineer, not in this state, and We do. He does a lot of solar stuff. He's written some books, and I supply him with tanks for his projects, and we go back and forth. He sometimes can drive me crazy because he asks endless questions. And I zinged him this week with something he hadn't thought of, which was and I think I've talked about it on this show. And at some point, we're going to have a YouTube up on it because I've just disclosed it to him. It's a reservoir that allows easy filling of heating systems. We came up with it for our solar system to introduce antifreeze in the system without having to use a pump, and eliminates a lot of hardware. And I laid it on him this week. He was going to a conference in Vermont, and I know that. And it's not something I make and sell. It's just something I've been fooling with that works well. I do sell it with our solar systems. And I kind of knocked his socks off, which was kind of fun. I mean, because usually he's asking me questions, questioning everything I do, which I've learned not to take as an insult. But there's times you're like, you know, I think I know what I'm doing. You don't have to keep asking me. It's not a bad thing to be questioned, though. But anyway, so he goes to this conference in Vermont, which I'm sure he disclosed it to the universe. So I'm expecting to see it in print at some point, probably without my name. Probably with his name. Back to the phones we go. Good morning. You're on The Voice of Maine.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
A couple years ago, you and Professor Hill did this mathematical thing about pellets versus wood versus oil and BTUs and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it all down. That's cool. And, of course, I forgot everything. But bottom line, I just want your opinion on what is the break-even point on going from pellets to oil. I know there are a lot of variables there. I know I happen to have a Harman pellet stove, which heats the whole house very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a Pennsauti oil-fired burner, a boiler. And I'm just wondering, let's say I pay an average of $5 for pellets. I may get them a little less, a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And oil right now is about $2.60-something up here where we're at. And I'm just curious, is there a benchmark? Is there something you can just say, well, yeah, if it gets over $3 a gallon for oil, maybe pellets are the best deal?
Well, a bag of pellets, I think, is 40 pounds usually.
Yes.
And if you assume, if you look at the bag, they usually are 7,000 to 8,000 BTUs per pound.
That's correct.
So you're talking 280,000 BTUs per bag for that $5 or so bag. So that's about a wash between the two at this point.
It's just six of one, half the other.
Yeah, and
but if oil goes up to like $3.75,
and the pellets stay the same, then you know. The deal is this: we're into the season now, so pellet prices and oil prices tend to stay a little bit higher. Pellets you can buy and store perhaps more easily than oil. Oil you're limited to whatever size storage you have. Pellets you can put them in the living room,
right.
Make furniture out of them, whatever, till you need them.
Right.
There's a little more potential there to buy them when they're cheaper. Not many people do that, though. I personally, the pellets, I kind of prefer for any number of reasons, not the least of which is they're from our state normally. But right now we're out of wash.
Okay, that's cool. Okay, that's a good benchmark. That's
okay.
What I need.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much,
okay.
Sir.
Right. Yep. Bye-bye. Let's see. We got a text here. Let me hit that button. We got a text. Can you go over the proper size type heat pump for mid-Maine winter temperatures? Some of them don't work that cold, I've been told. It's true. You need to read the label, so to speak. The specifications will usually tell you how cold they will operate at, what's the low temperature they'll operate at. The trade-off is that at that low temperature, they derate, so they usually lose maybe 40 to 60% of their capacity or their heating capacity at that low end. And that can be a detriment if you're right at the cusp, let's say it's rated 14,000 BTUs an hour, and your heat load is maybe 20,000 BTUs an hour. Design temperature, which is 10 below zero, excuse me. You're going to come up short if it's 14,000 BTU unit, that's rated usually at around freezing. Okay. So if the heat load is 14,000 BTUs at 10 below, when you get to 10 below, you're 40% under that rating, if I'm making sense to you. So you're going to come up shy. So if the heat load, again, this whole heat load thing, the whole way we insulate the building, this is the determining factor here. So if you wanted to do it with, say, near 100% or 100% with a heat pump, you might have to have two heat pumps. So you're spending more money on the heat pump and more money on energy for when it is below zero, 10 below zero. The good news is it's not often that cold, and the average temperature in the state of Maine is right around freezing, the average. So there are times it's above average, times it's below average, and it averages out to be pretty decent. But January, February, maybe December, depending on the winter, you're gonna you still got to pay. Now, having said that, the heat pump, there's a lot of heat pumps out there. You can get on a website, you get like on Home Depot website and look at heat pumps. You get on eBay and look at heat pumps. There's a lot of heat pumps that are not very efficient. They work. They'll heat your house. They'll cool your house. They work just like heat pumps. You put them in just like a heat pump, but they're not the same as the ones that are really rated more for our climate. And the two that kind of have, well, two or three, I guess, at this point that have proven themselves is the Fujitsu, Mitsubishi, and Daikin. Those three units in particular are around for a reason and are used a lot for a reason because they do stand up and they do perform at these lower temperatures. And that does make a difference. At any rate, that's what that's all about. Phone number is 1-800-966-1039 to Texas 601-207-4478. We still got a couple minutes to go here. What else do I have to tell you? I guess it's about. I still have in my work in our new building. I think I said first hour. I've got all the framing up that I'm putting for holding the foam insulation in place that we're doing, and I still have ice on the floors. I haven't run the heat in a week. Of course, I have only been there a couple days working, but the ice on the slab is slowly sublimating. It's slowly evaporating off the surface, but it ain't happening very fast. And today, I guess I'm over there. I'll have the heat running, so we'll tend to melt a little bit more. I'm sorry. I had a text earlier about what's the best way to insulate one of those pull-down attic access ladders, and I didn't answer it. You can buy them you can buy like what is essentially a foam box pre-made that sits on top that you can pop up, or you can make one yourself out of some sheet foam. And I would say I would go to Home Depot or a lumber yard and get 2-inch foil-faced foam. One sheet will do it for you. It might be about $40. I haven't priced it there lately. But you can cut that up. It's foil-faced. Maybe get a roll of foil tape and a can of foam, and you can make the enclosure by doing a couple of simple things. Cut the pieces, and then you can hold the pieces together with big nails and use canned adhesive to help glue it together. If you have foam on foam, you trim back the foil, foam to foam, it'll bond. And then reinforce that joint with foil tape on the inside and outside. And it'll be structural enough. You can pick it up, put it down, and you're going to make yourself a cover that's going to be a fraction of what a pre-made one. Pre-made one probably is $150, $250, depending on the quality. You can make your own with one sheet of, I think, 4x8 foam that's got foil facing. It doesn't have to be foil faced, but it's just easier. You can do that double or actually triple assembly process, in that you're using the can foam as an adhesive, you're using the nails to hold it together while the can foam cures, and you're using the tape to seal the joints and reinforce the whole process. So the can foam is what, $4. The roll of foil tape might be a little more, but if you got something like Gorilla tape, that would work too. A standard cheap duct tape is going to fail. Don't even bother to get it. Get something that will not dry out, and you may have to look a little more at the labels. Masking tape will not work. Foil tape will work. And if you can't find it affordably anywhere, you can always check Martin's. Sometimes you can really score a good deal on foil face tape over to Martin's. Sometimes you can't. Then I'd also look on on eBay. Been there, done that. Actually, years ago, I bought a whole bunch of aircraft foil tape, which is real heavy duty, on the eBay. The roll was heavy as all get out. It was really good stuff. Apparently, they use this someplace to stick something on an airplane together. So, anyway, you know what? We're out of time. I got to go. See you next week, same time. Stay warm. Enjoy the weekend. It's going to be sunny, I guess, so that's something.